From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On the first Middle East trip of his presidency, George W. Bush jumped in with both feet today, meeting with Arab leaders in Egypt to advance the so-called roadmap for Israeli-Palestinian peace. Years of bloodshed have left Israelis and Palestinians alike desperate for a change, and the U.S. finally ready to broker a solution. Tonight on Point, how hard will George W. Bush push for peace in the Middle East? We begin in the Egyptian Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh, where President Bush met today with leaders of Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and the Palestinian Authority to discuss the so-called roadmap to peace between Israelis and Palestinians. Maura Reynolds, White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, is in Sharm el-Sheikh traveling with the president. I asked her to describe the news emerging from that meeting.
The headline is that Bush sought and received support from important Arab leaders for his Middle East peace plan. There are still some questions about how broadly these leaders represent the Arab community, whether this can be seen as the Arab world as a whole signing on in any way. But for the most part, U.S. officials are quite joyous. They think that the president made great strides here today and, most importantly, set up his meetings tomorrow with Israeli Prime Minister Sharon and Mahmoud Abbas, the new Palestinian prime minister.
Concretely, what are the Bush administration officials so happy about after this meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh?
They have two concrete things that they are listing as signs of success. One is a very strong statement voiced by Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak denouncing terrorism. It was quite a broad statement, and it was on behalf of all the other countries, including Saudi Arabia. And there have been many questions, as you probably remember, about Saudi charitable organizations funneling money to various terrorist groups, including al-Qaeda and others that support Palestinian terrorists. The statement says that the Arab leaders denounce terrorism in all of its forms. They also denounce a culture of extremism that can lead some to terrorism. The second thing that they earned was a pledge from the Saudis to put much stricter controls on their charitable organizations. In particular, they have said that what they will do is organize a central organization to funnel all Saudi charity, and that organization will be monitored by the government to make sure that money does not wind up in the wrong hands.
Is there a sense, Maura Reynolds, among the American party there that this kind of pledge could, in fact, restrict funds to Palestinian terrorists and lead to a diminution in terrorism?
Well, they certainly seem to think that that's what they have won. I mean, it does remain to be seen. People who understand this far better than I could question whether it would still be possible for individual Saudis, for instance, to send money various places that they shouldn't, whether this is adequate law enforcement control. Mubarak specifically mentioned that, however, so that they would tighten enforcement to whatever degree they could. But it still remains to be seen. This is all just laying the groundwork, U.S. officials say, for a process that will need to go on for a long time.
And through their pledges and statements today in Sharm el-Sheikh, did the Arab leaders seem to be fully signing on to the roadmap for peace process?
Yes. But, of course, there are, after that, yes, you know, some, I wouldn't call it exactly caveats, but some concerns. And the main one is that they are really waiting to see some demonstration of support from the Israelis. And they have said this quite specifically. They want to see restrictions lifted, for instance, on Palestinian movement. They want to see real commitment to dismantle settlements. They have a whole laundry list of things that they really feel that Israel has been waiting too much in the wings on the roadmap, and that it's really time for Prime Minister Sharon tomorrow in Aqaba to step forward and demonstrate a similar amount of support for the roadmap.
Maura, what's your sense of what President Bush brought or said to get the buy-in that he did from these Arab leaders today?
That's actually interesting you should ask, because nobody knows. And the reason nobody knows is that this summit meeting did not come off precisely as planned. There was supposed to be a very large multilateral meeting with all of the leaders and all of their staff members, and there was a large room with lots of chairs around it, which of this was supposed to take place. But in fact, the leaders themselves spent an hour and a half in the anteroom before coming into the meeting and, in fact, held their meetings entirely in private with no one there but interpreters, not even with note takers. So, in fact, no one's really quite sure what Bush said to them today.
So we won't know what was said there, but in public, Bush was making very strong statements today in advance of his planned meetings tomorrow with the heads of Israel and with Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas. And I'm sure you saw this. He said, when I say something, I mean it. Then he went on to say, the world needs to have a Palestinian state that is free and at peace. I believe now is the time to work to achieve the vision. This is pretty strong language from an American president who's just come off a victorious war.
Yes, it is. It's there for two reasons. The first reason is that both sides, both the Israelis and Arab states, have been saying for a long time that there will never be peace in the Middle East until the American president invests himself personally and fully into the process. And Bush was trying to indicate today that that is precisely what he is now doing. The second reason is that he said nearly a year ago in his Rose Garden address on June 24th, that some fundamentals have to change in the Middle East in order for peace to take hold. And the first thing on the U.S. list was a change in the Palestinian leadership, which they believe they have now managed to midwife with the new Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas. But it's also important to note that this summit is coming after the war in Iraq, which, although Arab states strongly oppose the U.S. action there, they could not help but notice the demonstration of American strength and American determination. And I think Bush is riding on all of those things right now to try to finally get some kind of peace in the Middle East, which many American presidents have been working for many years.
And with all that, Maura, do you have a sense that President Bush feels himself going into tomorrow's big meetings with momentum?
I think he does feel that. It remains to be seen whether there is, in fact, an Arab undertow. For instance, some people have noted that Hosni Mubarak's statement today was not a particularly strong personal endorsement of Prime Minister Abbas. It mentioned him, but it did not say that we now recognize him as our primary interlocutor with the Palestinian Authority. And also, there have been some indications that there has been talk of trying to accelerate the Arab process of recognizing the State of Israel. They do not seem to have made much progress on that today, but it would remain part of the roadmap process. So there are a few indications that there may still be some Arab hesitancy, but whether that will, as I said, become a serious undertow really remains to be seen.
So plenty of room for undertow, but so far so good. Maura Reynolds, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Maura Reynolds, White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with me earlier from Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. For a region still stunned by the U.S.-led war in Iraq, Let's Roll President George W. Bush had more news today. The world needs a Palestinian state and Israeli security, and the time to make both happen is now, said the president. Tomorrow, Bush meets with Ariel Sharon and Mahmoud Abbas. Today, on the Red Sea, the famously determined American president was all determination, not to let, quote, a few killers thwart the dreams and hopes of many. Weary Israelis and Palestinians have called for the U.S. to finally push peace forward over the opposition of extremists on both sides. But can it be done? Is Bush the right man in the right position to do it? Can the United States afford to let this conflict go on? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Bethesda, Maryland, is Dennis Ross, director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He was special Middle East envoy and chief U.S. negotiator in the Clinton and Bush 1 presidencies. Good evening and welcome, Dennis Ross.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. Also with me tonight from Arlington, Virginia, is Shibli Telhami Anwar Sadat, professor for peace and development at the University of Maryland and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He is author of The Stakes, America and the Middle East. Good evening and welcome, Shibli Telhami.
Good evening to you.
Thanks to both of you for being with us quite a day. Images from these leaders on the Red Sea and talk of great things. Dennis Ross, first to you. How do you read the statements coming out of Sharm el-Sheikh today?
Well, I think they represent that we have a beginning, and I think that's how we have to understand this. We're not in the business of concluding. We're in the business of beginning. We've had a war between Israelis and Palestinians for the last 2.5 years, certainly for the last 2 years. We've had a dialogue only of violence. We've not had a dialogue of communication. We are at a point where, in fact, we need to have a new beginning, and I think the president has helped to create a new beginning. The real question is how we capitalize on it. The imagery is good. The reality is going to take a long time to change, and it's going to take determined involvement. It's going to take a tedious, frustrating diplomatic effort. But if we are prepared to stick with it, which I think is going to be the real question mark, then I think we have a chance at least to end the war and get back to peacemaking.
Shibli Tilhami, is there a long time for this process? If the roadmap is to be followed, there's to be a Palestinian state by the year 2005. That's year after next.
Yeah, it's a very rapid movement, and clearly, it requires tremendous amount of energy. And I think, as Dennis pointed out, this is merely a beginning. You have tremendous suspicion on the ground, not only mistrust, but suspicion of U.S. intentions and whether the U.S. means business, whether this is only a one-shot deal for the president to get pictures, or whether, in fact, the U.S. is going to be determined to push this through, because short of that, it's impossible to imagine that Israelis and Palestinians will be able to do it on their own, given this extraordinary timetable that is dependent on reciprocal moves on both sides. So I think there is an opportunity, and I think the opportunity is to be found in two areas. One is that the president, at least, has said that he really means business. We'll see. The second is that Arab leaders, I think, over the past 2.5 years have concluded that without a peace process, their own governments are in danger. They have an angry public that has been watching the violence and what they believe are helpless Palestinians, and the governments want to maintain their relations with the U.S., but they also want to reduce the anger of the public. They've all decided that they are better off working with the U.S. if the U.S. is serious about making peace. That's a new opportunity.
Dennis Ross, is there any way to push this forward on a different kind of timetable than we've seen in the past? Repeatedly, as negotiations labor forward, violence intervenes and things get derailed. George Bush has shown that he's willing, certainly was willing in war with Iraq, to step up and move adroitly, move quickly. Is there a way to kind of short-circuit the paces of the past and move on into a new tempo here?
Well, I'm skeptical of that, because in the end, we will not be the ones who make the peace. It still has to be a peace that is made by Israelis and Palestinians. They're going to have to be the ones who make these decisions. They're going to be the ones who have to invest in them, defend them, stand by them, believe in them. They can't be imposed from the outside, because they won't endure. So it has to be something that they're prepared to do. What has to happen first is to reestablish faith in the idea of peace itself. What has to happen is a reestablishment of what I call the core bargain of the peace process, which is the Israelis get security and the Palestinians get an unmistakable pathway to produce independence. There's going to have to be enough that happens on the ground from both sides to prove that that bargain is real. If you reestablish faith in that bargain, and it won't happen overnight, then you may be able to accelerate the process. But when you've lost faith, it's not something that can be easily reestablished. Shibley uses the word suspicion. The doubts are so deep on each side, the sense of cynicism is so great on each side, that they both wait for the worst to happen. Now, if you can confound that, if you can demonstrate that, in fact, it is a new day, that there is a recognition that the last 2.5 years have demonstrated unmistakably that there is no acceptable alternative to peaceful coexistence, then maybe you can begin to accelerate the process. But you've got to first create that basis and that foundation.
Shibli Tilhami, we just have a few seconds before the break, but are you of the same mind that only Israelis and Palestinians can make this peace? If that's the case, what's the U.S. role here? People are calling out for the U.S. to do something forceful. What is it?
I have to tell you, I agree with Dennis. I don't think a peace, an ultimate, the outcome can be imposed by an outside force. This is an existential issue for both sides. They're not going to accept anything that doesn't meet their minimal condition. However, the U.S. has tremendous leverage to impose a process and to, help build the trust that would help them move forward.
Shibli Tilhami, Dennis Ross, please stand by. We're talking this hour about a new push for Mideast peace and the depth of American commitment. How hard should the United States push all Mideast parties for Mideast peace now? And can George W. Bush, conqueror of Iraq, demand a peace settlement in the Middle East and get it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a new push for Mideast peace and the depth of American commitment. My guests tonight are Dennis Ross, director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and Shibli Telhami Anwar Sadat, professor for peace and development at the University of Maryland. You can join the conversation as well. Can Bush plus Sharon plus Abbas equal peace? Can the United States afford to let this conflict go on? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dennis Ross, Shibli Telhami was talking about United States leverage. You know something about that, having been chief special envoy for the U.S. there during two presidencies before this presidency. How great is that leverage? How is it best wielded? Has it been enhanced by the outcome of the war in Iraq?
The leverage is probably as great today as it has ever been. It is great in no small part because of the outcome in the war in Iraq. The fact is there is a perception in the region that if the United States decides it's going to do something, it's going to do it. And this president has a way of speaking bluntly and directly. So if he says he's going to do it, there is a kind of expectation that perhaps he will. Now, having said that, because the administration has pretty much been reluctant to be involved for the first two and third years of its of the presidency, there is not yet a conviction that what we've seen today represents what is going to be a determined American effort. But there certainly is at this point a readiness to recognize that if President Bush is prepared to be serious and follow through, that there will be an instinct to try to be responsive. Nobody wants to be seen as saying no to him right now, certainly not Ariel Sharon. And I would say that the Palestinians don't want to be seen as saying no to him. The Arabs don't want to be seen as saying no to him, especially because everybody has wanted so desperately to get the U.S. involved. Mm-hmm. So the fact that we're now at least appearing to be involved creates a circumstance where they're much more likely to be responsive to us. I agree very much with Shibley that we can help to impose a process. Now, the key is also to sustain the process, not just to establish it, but to sustain it. Here's where the issue of accountability is going to come in. The roadmap could not possibly be a blueprint because it was not negotiated with the parties who have to carry it out. It was negotiated with other members of the quartet, the EU, the Russians, the UN, and ourselves. None of us will carry out a single Israeli or Palestinian obligation. Each of them has to carry it out. What is required are clear-cut understandings with them, which we help to broker, we help to monitor, we ensure accountability. We have to establish in those understandings what, in fact, are unmistakable criteria for what constitutes performance. Well, now, that will require a very heavy American involvement.
Shibli, I hear you there.
Yeah, let me just say, you know, I agree with Dennis about up to a point about the leverage. I think with Arab governments, there is leverage. I think the Arab governments right now really don't have many options. They are sort of at some level more fearful of America than before the war, at another level more fearful of their own public than before the war. But at the public level, I don't think the U.S. today has more leverage. And I think that, you know, the suspicion of U.S. on this issue is so intense in the region. And I think having been promised over and over again that a solution is around the corner, that this is a new process, this is a new meeting, this is a new engagement, and have been disappointed over and over and over again. The Arab-Israeli conflict is a history of mostly disappointments. There were some bright spots, mostly disappointments for the region. And yet it's the core issue in the minds of many in the relationship with the U.S. And I think it's going to be very, very difficult to sustain a process on appearances and statements. There has to be some remarkable changes on the ground relatively rapidly. And that, frankly, means a lot of things, but two very important things. One is reduction, a marked reduction in violence, and some reversal of settlements. If those things don't happen, and happen very quickly, I don't think people are going to believe.
Shibli Telhami, Dennis Ross, I want to push both of you on this point of American leverage tonight and how it might be used. We've had these conversations for years and years and years about the peace process, and we've all seen what's happened. President Bush said again today, the world, not just Israel and the Palestinians, but the world needs peace here. We saw in Iraq that the United States was willing to kind of turn over the checkerboard there and say, we're not willing to accept the status quo at all. We're coming in here with a whole new vision. Is it possible that the United States, that this president, with his kind of determined approach to things, could change the terms, the pace fundamentally here? Could, instead of, Dennis Ross, you wrote today that this will be long and tedious and difficult. Is there no way to short-circuit that and say, all right, Israelis, Palestinians, you have failed to come to peace. We want to do more than just sit back and watch a process. We want to really push, and we're going to demand it. We're going to use the leverage we have in both quarters here with Israel and now post-war in the Arab world to forcefully push this forward. Is there no way for that to be productive?
The problem is if you don't change the reality on the ground, all the slogans in the world, all the best plans in the world will be overwhelmed by a bad reality.
But no one means just slogans. I mean, real leverage isn't about slogans. Real leverage is about requiring actions and having accountability for those actions.
Well, I'm all in favor of that. But I think what we're still going to have to see is we've got to see it happen. We haven't seen it happen yet. We see great determination in terms of posture. And as I get back to what I was saying before, you have to have very clear understandings. Now, we can help push those understandings. We can help make it more likely that they're achieved. We can help give each side some level of confidence about the consequence of doing this. But in the end, if they don't behave a certain way, if they don't change the realities, and here Shibley was talking about something I agree with, if the violence continues, you can forget it. If the Israeli behavior with regard to settlement activity doesn't change, you can forget it. Because in a sense, the reality on the ground will overwhelm what you're trying to do. Now, the question is, can our involvement, can we help ensure that the realities change? There is the potential to create a certain momentum behind what I would call good behaviors. I once talked about the importance of us creating in the process a code of behavior, a code of conduct, where each side would avoid those steps that create problems for the other. Now, we have to establish a baseline where first each side can demonstrate if they undertake an obligation, they'll actually fulfill it. There isn't a belief on either side that that's the case today. Some people around Prime Minister Sharon acquiesced in his support for the roadmap, at least in principle, and his statements on the grounds that, well, we can do this because in the end, the Palestinians won't fulfill their obligation, so in the end, we won't have to either. There's a lot of that going on each side right now. We have to change that.
Dennis Ross, if I may, just for a moment, Shibley Talami. Dennis Ross, with complete respect, because I've seen your work over so many years and enormously admiring of it, but the threat to even American security seems tied up in this conflict now. Is there, and what I hear still is talk of leverage, but I don't hear you describing a real application of American power. But we know it can be applied. America has real material leverage with both of these communities. Cannot a line be drawn between American power and settlements, between American power and terror, and then line then pulled and said, we want action here, and we're not suggesting it. We're not just creating a framework. We demand it. Dennis Ross, you first, and Shibley, I'll be right there.
Well, I would say, again, there's a question of the abstraction in terms of the capability, and there's the practical reality of it. Look at what we've done just in terms of putting together a roadmap. The roadmap itself is not precise at all. I mean, if we were truly demanding action, what we would have done is we would have created our own criteria for what would constitute performance. On the Israeli side, we would outline the specific number of settlement outposts or settler outposts that had to be dismantled. Mm-hmm. We would have defined precisely what a settlement freeze was. We would have explained what we expected and when we expected it. On the Palestinian side, we would have explained what does dismantling terrorist infrastructure mean. We would have said who has to be arrested and when they have to be arrested. None of that is in the roadmap. So I guess I would say before I become persuaded that we're prepared to transform the reality that way by establishing a criteria and then trying to insist that there be a response to it, first we have to demonstrate we're prepared to establish such a criteria.
Well, I think your point is extremely important for the following reason. I mean, obviously, leverage needs to be used with both sides, but there is an asymmetry of power on the ground, and the roadmap itself is highly dependent on reciprocal measures. If the Palestinians do not comply with a particular measure, Israel has the power to punish them by not withdrawing, by maintaining an occupation, by increasing checkpoints.
All the ways we've seen.
All of the sort of measures it can do as a power as an occupying. But the Palestinians do not really have the power to punish Israeli noncompliance.
Terror, and exploded buses, body parts in Haifa?
Well, and that they have to stop. So we're saying that legitimate, the sort of measures that a party is allowed or can have in the context of the roadmap.
Okay.
I mean, that's the point. Obviously,
but your point being there what?
I mean, that's the point. And so in order for you to be moving forward, you have to put forth, certainly the Palestinian Authority doesn't have that measure. Maybe segments of the Palestinian public do, but the Palestinian Authority, which will be committed by default, by entering into this arrangement, to nonviolence, or at least nonviolence from its side, clearly it's dependent. You need a third party. In the U.S. side, a survey was done last week by the University of Maryland in the U.S., and what is interesting is the American public would think more highly of the president if he took a leadership role on this issue, the Arab-Israel issue, even if he failed. And two-thirds of the American public want the U.S. to take an even-handed approach, and majority of the American public support the U.S. putting real pressure, and by real pressure was meant economic and military measures vis-a-vis both sides, the Palestinians and the Israelis.
Shilu, let me ask you in that case, why do you think, is President Bush getting involved now because of those kind of poll numbers, because he's planned it all along to come post-war? And if he's serious, why hasn't the United States, as Dennis Ross says, given a line-by-line set of demands for each side here?
Well, let me give you three reasons why he's gotten involved. One is, obviously, he promised a lot of people that he's going to do it during the Iraq War, and that includes Blair and some of his Arab allies, so he's fulfilling. Second, there's learning. Every president comes in saying, I don't care about this issue. It's a losing proposition. It's a headache. And by the end of the first or second year, they know that it's unavoidable. It's strategically critical for the U.S. They have to deal with it. But in this case, there's a third, which is, remarkably, this turns out to be a diversion from the Iraq story. What you have right now is bad news out of Iraq in the short term. There is no avoiding that. Is not likely to be very good news. If it's going to be good news, it's going to be long term. And right now, oddly enough, the anger both here in America in terms of what we see happening in Iraq and what the public in the Middle East sees happening in Iraq, the fact that the U.S. is involved is a positive for the president, is a positive for the U.S. perception. Mm. But then in addition to that, you take the role of the Europeans and other international parties. All of them want to see the president involved. In a way, this is an issue over which they can bridge the gap of difference, whereas issues like Iraq are divisive issues in that relationship. So, yes, the president has a lot of incentives. The real question is whether he sees that, whether he's willing to make this a priority issue. I'm not persuaded he's decided to.
We're left wondering whether this is an issue of bone-deep determination. Listeners, we're talking about a new push in the Middle East tonight. Can this peace push be different than its predecessors? We're at 1-800-423-8255 with Shibli Telhami and Dennis Ross. Nasser's calling from Boston. Hi, Nasser. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I disagree with the two of your guests. I think the U.S. can exert pressure on both parties here. And I can support that by asking, why did we send about 250,000 troops into Iraq? And we took that risk, yet we cannot exert some level of pressure against the government of Israel, which occupies the Palestinian lands.
But there is pressure, Nasser. I mean, Ariel Sharon is sitting down tomorrow with George Bush and Mahmoud Abbas. He has spoken, favorably of the roadmap. It took pressure to get that to happen.
That's right, Tom. But consider also 15 reservations. The Israelis have a veto over the roadmap. And I do not think George W. Bush, given the elections next year, that he will be basically yielding, he will be defying Sharon because of the domestic vote here in the U.S. So I think, what we need to do is start really looking into the things on the ground. I think there's a lot of suffering in both parts. I just came back from Palestine about a month and a half ago, and it's unbelievable suffering on the part of the Palestinians. If we want to continue just talking about Israeli security, which is a broad definition, yet not mentioning the daily suffering of the Palestinian public, that's 3.5 million suffering in a daily basis.
Nasser, we've got it, and we're looking looking at both tonight. We want to take both straight on. But Dennis Ross, the issue is what the United States can do. Do you see a setting now where this can be brought back with some kind of alacrity to the point that negotiations had reached in the year 2000? Or is it even a struggle to get back to that point?
Well, it certainly will be. I think the objective has to be, how do you create an environment where you can get back to doing that? Again, what this president is doing is trying to resume a process where the two sides can talk to each other. He's not taking on the issues we did. I mean, he's changed American policy.
We being the Clinton administration,
right.
You're saying.
He's changed American policy in one important respect. He has made it clear that the outcome has to be a two-state solution with the state of Palestine,
mm-hmm.
which, interestingly enough, even though we put ideas on the table that would have provided for an independent Palestinian state, we withdrew those ideas when they weren't accepted. Now, what we did, however, was also define that state in terms of its borders, its powers, and its capital. What you have right now is an undefined state.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of a vision of a Palestinian state is a vision without definition. And you've got to recreate an environment where you can take on those issues. Those issues aren't being taken on now because first you have to establish the ability to talk to each other again. So we are, A, at the beginning. B, this notion that we can exert our pressure and everything will fall into place, I think it reflects the frustration with what is this ongoing conflict. But I think we also have to be realistic. There is no such thing as an imposed outcome because one side or the other will defect as soon as they can. And I don't see, to try to equate this to Iraq, there's nobody who's an equivalent of Iraq in this situation. Look at how this president looked at Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
He saw him as a threat to the national security of the United States, to our vital interests.
But what if the conflict itself it constitutes such a threat?
The question is, will he ever see it that way? And I doubt it.
Well, he said today the world needs a Palestinian state. He said many times the world needs Israeli security. That sounds like he's edging up toward that.
What we hear in his words is a determination to do something. But I think what we also have to see is behaviors that reflect that. I believe the president is quite sincere in terms of wanting to do something. But I don't think the administration yet fully appreciates how hard the task is going to be.
May I come in a little bit, please. Because I think it just should be some clarification. There's a difference between exerting leverage to propel the process forward, including pressure, and between imposing the terms of a settlement. Frankly, I think even the Clinton administration could not impose a settlement on a much weaker Palestinian side in Camp David, too.
But we're told that everything is different post 9/11. What about this?
But let me say that leverage, I think the U.S. can impose leverage, and I think the U.S. can pressure both sides. And I think the settlement issue, for example, is very much an issue where you have already some majority in Israel supportive of reversing settlements. And therefore, that's not an imposition of terms. That is essentially creating incentive of a step that is absolutely necessary to move forward. And I think that the U.S. has the capacity to do it. In fact, I think public opinion in the U.S. shows that most Americans are supportive of such a position.
We have to take a short break. Please stand by. We're talking tonight about a new push for Mideast peace and the depth of American commitment. Can this peace push be different than its predecessors? Does George Bush now have the stature to demand major concessions from all sides? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a new push for Mideast peace and the depth of American commitment to that push. My guests are Dennis Ross, director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and special Middle East envoy under the Clinton administration and the Bush 1 presidency. And joining us tonight also, Shibli Telhami Anwar Sadat, professor for peace and development at the University of Maryland. You can join us as well. Can the United States afford to let this conflict go on? Should Washington strap in for the long term here or push for firm, fast results like the roadmap's Palestinian state in 2005? Is there a chance for a dramatic breakthrough here, even a forced breakthrough? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Alan is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Hi, Hi, Tom. I want to agree with your previous caller, I think his name was Nasser, that
yes.
the fact on the ground is that 3.5 million Palestinians are suffering increasingly with each passing day and each passing month, and that is the reality that has generated the terror bombings that we all deplore.
Well, a lot of terror preceded the full impact of Palestinian suffering that's there today. I mean,
it's getting worse, and that's why it's getting worse, and the suicide bombing is relatively recent in the 35-year history of occupation. But let me make my point. My point is that our government could end this conflict in an eye blink, and I can write the speech for George Bush, and what it would say is that we can't tell any country what to do, but we don't have to pay for what they do. And the elephant sitting in the living room that no one wants to talk about is that the United States has funded these consistent violations of human rights by the Israeli occupation force. $3 billion a year. Now they're asking for more. They're going to get more. If the United States said in a convincing way to Israel, to the Israeli government, you are not going to get another penny from us until you withdraw your forces behind the green line and you allow an independent Palestinian state to be formed under United Nations auspices, it would happen in a week. If the Israelis believed that, they would withdraw. There would be peace.
But there's an American commitment to Israeli security that would probably preclude that.
Israeli security would be guaranteed. What's the United States going to go away? Does anybody believe that for a minute?
But that $3 billion is presumably part of that security. But we'll pick it up, Alan. Dennis Ross, what about this as a leverage point? I don't know. It may sound radical, but we're told post 9/11 everything has changed. Actions have changed. Presumptions have changed.
I would tell you, the Israelis under those circumstances would dig in, say, forget it.
Mm-hmm.
They would use their nuclear deterrent to say, if this is what it takes for us to hold on, we will do it.
But a nuclear deterrent against the Palestinians right next door?
Well, against anybody who's threatening them. The fact of the matter is, if I were an Israeli, I'd have to tell you, I don't know that I would trust in those circumstances, if the Israelis were to get out with no guarantees other than the UN, which provided wonderful guarantees for the Israelis in the UNIFIL in southern Lebanon. The Israelis are not about to entrust their security to the UN. They're not about to believe that the Palestinians in such a circumstance would, in fact, fulfill all their obligations. Many Palestinians might well draw the conclusion, gee, if you force the Israelis to do this, why stop at the 67 borders?
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to produce a peace by simply announcing we're going to coerce it, and that's going to be the result. You know, there's a big difference. Shibley was making this point, and I think he's right. There's a distinction between our exerting leverage
yes.
and us applying the kind of coercion that creates a quixotic solution that is no solution at all.
But on the other hand, and Shibley, I'll put it to you, I mean, we have watched Israelis and Palestinians for so many years and watched them go through so much suffering and watched them demonstrate, it seems to me, an inability to make peace. What do we do about that?
No, I think there's no doubt in my mind that they're not likely to be able to break out of the cycle on their own. And I think it does mean that the U.S. is going to have to use leverage, including economic leverage, vis-a-vis both. And as I said, the American public supports it. I think an interesting point that should be brought in relation to the caller's point about how to describe the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, the survey by the University of Maryland last week showed that only 17% of the American public believe that the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians is about terrorism, or that it's part of the worldwide war on terrorism, that it is similar to the U.S. war with al-Qaeda. And the vast majority saw it for what it really is, and that is that it's a nationalist conflict over land. People understand what this conflict is, and this, by the way, has not changed in the past year because a similar survey was done exactly a year ago.
But an awful lot of Americans also see terrorism and feel sympathy for the victims of terrorism.
Well, they certainly do, but they don't equate the conflict with that. They understand that this is a bigger conflict, and in fact, when you ask them two questions, one is, do you want the U.S. to have an even-handed policy toward the Palestinian-Israeli conflict? Do you want it to be pro-Israel? Do you want it to be pro-Palestinian? The vast majority, two-thirds, want it to be even-handed. So clearly the American public has its mind made up on this issue and in fact, has not been much affected by the coverage of terrorism over the past year. Which
but made up
really
in such
remarkable.
A way that it's politically consequential, Shibley Talhami, or not?
Well, if the president wants to make this issue of a priority, he has the makings of a political constituency across the board, even among those who said that they would vote in part on the basis of this issue. So this, I think, it's really a question of a choice for the White House. Does the White House want to make this a priority issue and therefore coming at the expense of a host of other issues on the agenda? If he does, the president has the ability to make the case to the American public because the American public really believes this is an important issue and they want to see the U.S. involved. And by involvement, they mean more than just having meetings.
We have a lot of callers who want to join us. I want to bring them in. Joanne's on the line. Hi, Joanne. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi. It just seems after September 11th, President Bush made a speech and he's went on and on about how we were not going to distinguish between terrorists and the states that harbor them.
Yes, he did.
And we go to war against in Afghanistan, and we go to war in Iraq, yet now, when it comes to this Israeli situation, now we're going to negotiate with Palestinians, which doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, I look at it, and I see, contrarily to what the speaker just said, I see one tiny nation, Israel, surrounded by 22 enormous Arab nations, many of which are bent on Israel's destruction.
Well, Joanne, let me ask you, at Sharm el-Sheikh today, President Bush got a statement from Arab leaders, at least four of them, saying that they would not be putting in money that could end up in the hands of terrorists, that they would clamp down on support of terrorism. Do you believe that that will happen?
No, I don't. There hasn't been anything to date, that even though they say that they renounce, a lot of Arab leaders have said they renounce terrorism, yet it continues.
Joanne, let me put it to Dennis Ross. Dennis, first of all, do you think there can be, will be, a material consequence from these four Arab leaders saying that they'll crack down on funds flowing toward terrorists? And more than that, can the Bush, as Joanne raises, can the Bush administration forthrightly pursue its war on terrorism and at the same time stand up for Palestinian statehood without a conflict?
Well, I think it can. Let me deal with the second one first, and then I'll deal with the with the first part of it second. I think one of the important things for this president is to be very clear that he supports Palestinian statehood, as he has said, but he should also have a corollary to that, which is there'll be no Palestinian state born of violence. To send the message unmistakably, you're going to achieve statehood, those who will pursue violence will defer that time until such time as the violence ends. Now, I think there's a reality here that the Palestinians themselves have come to understand. One sees, A, polls among the Palestinians now wanting to see an end to the violence. B, we see a reform movement on the Palestinian side that reflects a readiness on their part to assume responsibility for themselves. This is a very important development, and it creates the possibility, I think, for real change.
Dennis, let me ask you just on that point. Do the Palestinians have the capacity to turn off the terrorism? Does the Palestinian Authority really have the power, the means, to make terrorism go away in Israel?
No, not right now. There is a way to approach this. This is where the Israelis can take steps that helps Abu Mazen build his authority. He has a capacity in Gaza to take steps. He doesn't have the same kind of capacity in the West Bank. But one of the things that can happen is the Palestinians can stop the incitement. They can stop the glorification of those who carry out suicide bombing. They can delegitimize the use of terror in the pursuit of the cause. One of the things that Abu Mazen, in fact, began to do in his very first statement to the Legislative Council right before they voted for him, when he said he was denouncing terror for moral and religious reasons, but he also said it takes a just cause, namely the Palestinian cause, and it destroys it.
Yes.
Now, the more you delegitimize it, the more you make it more difficult for some of these groups to operate. And this, by the way, is where the Arabs have a role to play as well. It's not just turning off the money, which, by the way, should have happened before today. It's also a case of making it clear that there's a legitimate way to pursue the Palestinian cause and there's an illegitimate way to do it. And those who pursue it illegitimately are enemies of the cause and will have to be treated as such.
But may I look at it a little bit differently?
Shibli Tilhami, please.
I think there's no question that when you look at terrorism, that is attacks against innocent civilians, there is a supply side and demand side. There are the organizers, and some of them are ambitious and really are not even going to be affected by political process. But there's the demand side, the fact that you have people who are willing to sacrifice their lives for something like this, who are recruitable. And it is very clear that there is a demand side that is going to be there. We're treating it as if you cut off the funds that would come from Saudi Arabia, it's going to end. There is going to be very little relationship, unfortunately, with that. Cutting off the funds that came from Saddam to the families of those suicide bombers, very little connection. Because there are more recruits, than you can ever imagine. In fact, they're lining up, and many of the organizations can't even figure out what to do with some of them and having to make decisions on that. Now, the reality of it is you have to look at it in the context of a dynamic game. In the 1990s, when in the middle of the peace process, when Dennis was there, and actually things looked optimistic, and
yes,
you asked Palestinians, do you support violence against innocent Israelis? The vast majority said no. And today, when you ask them, it's a different story. Hearts hardened on both sides, a dynamic game. You can't detach it from the reality of the conflict itself, and that's the dilemma. Is you can do some things, obviously, concretely,
yeah,
in addressing the supply side, but unless you have changes of the reality on the ground, the occupation for the Palestinians and the violence for the Israelis, it is going to be very, very difficult to get a handle, full handle on this issue.
Dennis,
I agree with that. I mean, the reality is we have to get back to what I described as the core bargain. I would put it a little differently. What do both sides seek? Both sides seek freedom. The Palestinians want freedom from the Israeli occupation, and the Israelis want freedom from the insecurity and the threat of terror. Now, you're not going to be able to achieve one without the other. The reality is both sides have to adopt postures right now that make it clear that they will fulfill certain obligations and that they also begin to address what are the fundamental concerns and doubts of the other side.
But how do you take it out of the hands or at least make it less vulnerable to the extremists who don't buy into that bargain, to Israelis who want the whole thing right straight over to Jordan, to Palestinians who want Israel gone? Isn't that the whole point, is to pull it out of that turf? And is that happening here, Dennis
Well,
Ross?
Look, one of the critical points is that in the 1990s we had a peace process of the mainstreams. The extremes resisted it. In the last 2.5 years, we've had the day-to-day governed by the extremes, not by the mainstreams. So what you have to get back to is having the mainstreams dominate. It is an extraordinary thing that Ariel Sharon says that the occupation, uses the term occupation and says it has to end. He talks about dividing the land.
Yes.
This takes the ideology of Likud and basically throws it out the window.
But then in the New York Times over the weekend, we read David Shipler saying, well, is Sharon playing a double game here? Is he just buying time, kind of, you know, taking a few punches and falling back? What do you think, Dennis Ross?
Well, I still say he used different terminology that lives. The terminology doesn't go away. He's established a new baseline. And Likud, which basically always viewed the land as indivisible and theirs, has now been put in a position where it's not theirs and it is to be divided. And the term occupation, he said it.
Yes.
He said it 5 times, and he said, you may not like the term. He did it quite deliberately. Now, that creates, as I said, a baseline. You have him saying things that his party has certainly never said before. You have Abu Mazen saying things that we never heard from Yasser Arafat. Now, that demonstrates that we do have something going for us in all of the difficulty. We do have, and I think Shibley is quite right, the Arabs have, I think, a different incentive right now than they've ever had before. We, for our part, also have to be prepared to stay the course. It will be difficult because when you talk at the level of slogans or you talk at the level of exhortation, you still have to contend with the way people are living.
Dennis Ross, our time is running out. A simple question. Do you expect to see the roadmap's Palestinian state in the year 2005?
I wish I could say yes. I'm not. I can't honestly say I believe we're going to see that by 2005.
And Shibley Telhami, if Dennis Ross, who's been at the heart of this, doesn't believe that's going to be there, how are we not just back on the same old treadmill here?
No, I'm afraid. I would love to see it, but I would have to be proven wrong in my assessment that it's not likely to happen by then.
Well,
we wanted to end on an optimistic note.
Well, I guess it's this.
And I promise to come back and be more optimistic.
No, that's all right. We don't demand optimism, but maybe this is a situation in which we sort of like that dogged George W. Bush to be in there being dogged and maybe just a little bit simplistic to push through some of this thicket. I don't know if it can be done, but let's hope. Dennis Ross, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Pleasure.
Dennis Ross is director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and Shibley Telhami, thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure.
Shibley Telhami is Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and author of The Stakes, America and the Middle East. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're